On this episode of Skeptico, a discussion between biologist Rupert Sheldrake and parapsychology skeptic Dr. Richard Wiseman.
Is there enough to prove that this remarkable thing called psi, and I think it is remarkable if it exists, and because the mainstream science is very conservative, it would be very slow to embrace something like that, but I believe that mainstream science would embrace it if the evidential base was strong enough. I think, for me, and I suspect for a lot of other scientists, it's not about a one-off study. It's not even about a single lab replicating that study. It would be about a large number of labs, many weren't being run by proponents, being able to run a psi study and reliably get a psi effect.
I just want to go back a bit to what Richard called the Humean argument against miracles. Hume's argument against miracles was that miracles are extremely rare, and it's more likely that people would be lying about them than that they actually happen, because they so defy the common experience of humanity. Now, I think the Humean argument is exactly reversed when it comes to phenomena like telepathy. They're not extremely rare. Whether it's 30%, 50%, 70% of the population have had them, the details don't matter. The point is these things are very common. And Hume's argument was that common sense, the kind of common experience of the bulk of humanity, is what gives credence to something. So I think it's completely inappropriate to apply an argument against miracles to phenomena which happen on an everyday basis to large numbers of people.
Stay with us for Skeptico.
Welcome to Skeptico, where we explore controversial science with leading researchers, thinkers, and their critics. I'm your host, Alex Sakaris, and on this episode coming up, I have what's turned out to be just a fascinating show. And before I get into the debate that I have today with Dr. Richard Wiseman and Dr. Rupert Sheldrake, I want to take a minute and express my gratitude for a couple of emails, or actually a number of emails that have come in, but a couple of them were really gratifying, and I wanted to acknowledge that. And one came from a listener who said that because of Skeptico, they were a little less willing to accept out of hand what they heard on the skeptical side of arguments about some of the issues that we cover. And I think because that's certainly a personal transformation that I've gone through, it was really gratifying to hear that from someone else who said it really better than I just said it there, but we'll leave it at that. And the second email I wanted to acknowledge was from someone who said that the show had helped them sort through some personal psychic experience they had that they didn't really understand and weren't able to, I guess, normalize, you might say, from a rational, logical standpoint. That's certainly very gratifying to me, because one of the things I realized when I got into Skeptico was that there are a lot of people who don't feel they have any place to turn when they have these kind of strange experiences. And if they're logic and reason-based, and it makes it even harder because they feel torn sometimes between proponents who are way extreme in a way that they don't feel comfortable with. And on the other side, they just see skeptics who are completely denying their experience, and they kind of feel torn in between. So again, very gratifying to feel that maybe this show has helped guide people towards the information, which is what this show is all about, is just exposing folks to the information, and then everyone does with it whatever you do with it. Follow the data, right? And, you know, the third theme that came through in some of the emails that I've been receiving, and I want to acknowledge, is that people are saying that they like to hear a civil discourse, an intelligent discourse, but a civil discourse, a hard, challenging point-counterpoint discourse, but a civil discourse. And I want to really listen to that and see if I can try and maintain that ability to hear the best that I can the other side, even if I don't agree with it. So that's going to be a challenge for me going forward. And of course, it's going to be a challenge for this show, because on one hand, we have someone in Dr. Rupert Sheldrake, who I greatly admire. Of course, Dr. Sheldrake is a noted biologist and a parapsychology researcher. We've covered his work on several episodes of Skeptico. And we have Dr. Sheldrake engaging with Dr. Richard Wiseman, who is quite a prominent skeptic, has been an occasional psi researcher and a psi debunker, and is kind of an interesting guy, kind of hard to figure. On one hand, he's been a collaborator in some psi research. On the other hand, he's been a very vocal detractor and debunker, really no other way to explain it, of Psi research. As we've covered on this show, some of the methods and means he's used to explore Psi phenomena, parapsychology phenomena, have been called into question as to whether or not they were really appropriate and proper in a scientific way. And those, of course, are topics that we've also covered in some depth here on this show. So today's episode came about because Dr. Wiseman recently published an article in the Skeptical Inquirer magazine where he called into question Psi research as a whole and reiterated this theme that you'll hear often among skeptics, which is you need to consider the null hypothesis. Psi researchers, you need to consider whether all this stuff that you're doing is just nothing. You need to consider that maybe there is no there there. And I think this really got the ire of Dr. Sheldrick, and he emailed me a copy of the article, and we arranged this dialogue, which I have to say it was very generous and nice enough of Dr. Wiseman to agree to come on. Again, these are difficult conversations to have. So we had this dialogue that you're going to hear in a minute, but what I wanted to also alert you to is the postscript, the round two or round three, in this case, round about 10 of this story. Because as with so many skeptical shows, what I've found, and it's just amazing because I never could have anticipated this, but that the real interesting part comes after the interview, comes after the follow-up, comes with the digging that goes on and the pushing on all the little loose ends that get left behind. And there's a lot of that in this case. So I hope you enjoy this debate with Sheldrick and Wiseman, but please, please stick around for the postscript because it's really the most interesting part of understanding the full context of what this is all about. Here's the debate. Well, we have a very special live dialogue today between Dr. Richard Wiseman, professor of psychology at University of Hertfordshire in the UK. And in addition to his job there at the university, Dr. Wiseman, as many of you know, is also a parapsychology skeptic and an author of many popular books such as Quirkology, which explores the quirky way our mind works. Greetings, Dr. Wiseman. Thanks for joining us today.
Pleasure to be here.
And we're also joined by Dr. Rupert Sheldrick, biologist, director of the Perot Warwick Project at Trinity College, Cambridge, and author of such books as A New Science of Life, a book about his morphic resonance theory. Welcome, Dr. Sheldrick.
Thanks for inviting me along.
So one of the things that sparked my interest in having this dialogue today was a recent article by Dr. Wiseman about the methods and results of parapsychology research. And I want to give both of you a chance to dig into the meat of that. But I thought we might start framing up this discussion by a point I think we'd find agreement on. And that's that these phenomena we're talking about, when we talk about psi or psychic abilities, these phenomena seem very real, or at least a very real possibility to most people. I mean, most people, either because they have some kind of personal experience or a family story, they suspect that something might be going on here. And they hear stories like, for example, everyone's heard the story about the twins who are separated by great distance, but when one of them suffers a severe trauma, the other one experiences it on some physical level. And we all hear these stories, and I think most people say, wow, I think that probably might happen some of the time. So I guess I'd start with each one of you by asking, one, whether or not you think that statement is true, whether most people think that there's some phenomena going on, and then two, how your particular research that you've done over the years comes into play in explaining this sense of connection that so many of us feel but can't quite explain. So would you like to start, Dr. Wiseman?
Certainly. So in terms of the first half of that, surveys tend to show that around about 50% of the population believe in some sort of ESP or psi phenomena. So very roughly, I mean, it varies from time to time and country to country, but very roughly about 50%. So that would suggest that, and when you ask people what that belief is based on, it's in terms of experiences, it's around about a third of people. So it suggests that roughly a third of the population have the sorts of experiences you're talking about, and then roughly 50% believe, and that, of course, leaves another 50% that don't have those experiences and don't believe. In terms of my own research, some of it has looked at the notion of certain individuals possessing very strong psychic abilities, the mediums and the psychics and so on, and I'm very, very skeptical about that data set. I don't think it shows anything particularly remarkable in terms of psychic abilities going on. And then I've done a small amount of work, although other people have done a lot more, into this notion that psi is this kind of slightly more subtle signal, and that gets us more into experimental parapsychology. There, I'm fairly skeptical about the literature. I certainly wouldn't want to argue the case that psi definitely exists on the basis of that literature. But as I've said elsewhere, it's also not clear to me that the skeptical position can explain everything that's going on there. So I think I see that literature more as a justification for carrying on rather than psi phenomena actually existing. And for me, the real issue is how do we carry on in the future in a way that we get to some sort of closure on the problem and that we're not having exactly the same discussion in 10 years' time.
Okay, Dr. Sheldrick, would you like to comment on any of that?
Yes. Well, Richard and I agree that a lot of people believe in these phenomena. I mean, the number who've experienced them, I think, is rather higher than he claims. But even if we take, say, a third of the population having had experiences, my own surveys and quite a number of others show it's more than that, especially with telephone telepathy. But anyway, a lot of people have had these experiences. My own approach in my own research has been to start from what people experience, not from laboratories, but to start with the actual experiences. And as part of that, I've built up large databases with thousands of stories from people about their experiences to build up a kind of natural history of what they claim is going on. For example, telephone telepathy is by far the commonest claim of telepathy in the modern world. I wouldn't have found that out unless I'd done surveys and carried out, built up databases. I also found that many people claim their pets are psychic, dogs that know when their owners are coming home, for example. And again, surveys show those things are quite common. About 50% of dog owners claim their animals anticipate the arrival of a member of the family. So there's no doubt these claims are common. In my experience, the people making these claims are not particularly credulous. Many of them do try to lean over backwards to think of normal explanations. And I think the evidence for these phenomena is quite good. It's happened under adverse conditions. Parapsychologists are quite a very small number of them. Grants are hard to come by. The subject is subject to an enormous amount of negative attitudes on the part of other academics, particularly by organized skeptic groups. So these conditions don't make it a very easy field to work in. But the thing that I rather disagree with Richard Wiseman on, the possibility of closure. I mean, he says that he wants closure. In his article in Skeptical Inquirer, he says he wants closure, and he's just said it now. I don't think that will happen because, in my experience, it's not really a question of evidence. I encounter skeptics the whole time. Some of them, like Richard, are well-informed. Others are extremely ill-informed, incredibly bigoted, very emotional. They know nothing about the evidence. They don't care. They don't want to know about the evidence. They're absolutely convinced these things are impossible, and everyone who says they're possible is a charlatan, a fraud, or stupid. And the remarkable thing for me is just the enormous strength of this incredibly strong kind of scientific fundamentalism. And I don't think one's ever going to convince people with that worldview on the basis of evidence, any more than one would convince creationists on the basis of evidence for evolution. So I think we're dealing with a kind of conflict of worldview here. And so admirable as this desire for closure may be, I just don't think it's going to happen.
Let me sharpen up that point just a little bit by interjecting something, and I'd throw in the phrase burden of proof. And I think maybe what this issue comes down to is, you know, at what point does the burden of proof shift from one side to the other, where it's obviously impossible scientifically to ever prove something, right? We're always just kind of nudging towards one theory or another. At what point does the evidence mount and the personal experience and personal history across time, across culture, of all these experiences. At what point does that gain enough weight to say, okay, now the burden of proof is on the other side to kind of disconfirm what seems to be going on here?
I don't think that ever happens in science. I mean, the burden of proof is always on the claimant to produce the evidence. To address Rupert's point, and it is a good one, there is certainly some individuals, I think, on each end of the spectrum, where this isn't about the evidence at all. So for some skeptics, it doesn't matter how much evidence you produce, they're not going to say this thing is true. And that's always the kind of Humean position, where you're talking about how much evidence would you need to create or believe that a miracle exists. And in a sense, it's always easier and in some ways more logical to believe that all your witnesses were lying or wrong or whatever. That's on one end of the spectrum. On the other end, you have the extreme believers who will never disbelieve, no matter how sort of flimsy the evidence. So I think those end groups, you're not going to shift one way or the other. What you have in the middle, though, of the spectrum is a group of people who I think are more reasonable and would look at the evidence and say, okay, what have we got here? Is there enough to prove that this remarkable thing called psi, and I think it is remarkable if it exists, is there enough evidence to say there's something going on? And because the mainstream science is very conservative, it would be very slow to embrace something like that, but I believe that mainstream science would embrace it if the evidential base was strong enough, but the evidential base does need to be very strong. And if you look at even parapsychologists looking at their own evidence, for the most part, they acknowledge it's not as strong as perhaps it should be and could be, and there are big issues, particularly about replication, and this gets to your burden of proof argument. I think, for me, and I suspect for a lot of other scientists, it's not about a one-off study. It's not even about a single lab replicating that study. It would be about a large number of labs, many of which weren't being run by proponents, being able to run a psi study and reliably get a psi effect. And parapsychology has come close to that in the past, but not achieved that. And my article was asking why that might be the case and what we might do differently in the future.
Dr. Sheldrick, do you have a quick response to that? And then I want to move on to the next issue, which I think rolls right into this.
Well, I just want to go back a bit to what Richard called the Humean argument against miracles. Hume's argument against miracles was that miracles are extremely rare, and it's more likely that people would be lying about them than that they actually happen, because they so defy the common experience of humanity. Now, I think the Humean argument is exactly reversed when it comes to phenomena like telepathy. They're not extremely rare. Whether it's 30%, 50%, 70% of the population have had them, and whether it's 50% of dogs or 40%, the details don't matter. The point is these things are very common. And in Hume's argument was that common sense, the kind of common experience of the bulk of humanity, is what gives credence to something. So I think it's completely inappropriate to apply an argument against miracles to phenomena which happen on an everyday basis to large numbers of people. So in my view, the burden of proof lies very much with skeptics to prove that their people are deluded about their own experience. So anyway, that's just not to take up the Humean argument, because I think it's a complete misuse of Hume to say that. But to come to the actual body of evidence, I think that I agree with Richard that it's not about one-off studies. It's about replication. But one more point about what people would embrace. It is a curious thing that the scientific community is not particularly conservative in some areas, but it's very conservative in this area. For example, when cosmologists come up with the idea that there are multiple universes, billions of actual universes besides our own, for which there's no evidence at all, instead of this causing outrage, it becomes totally mainstream. Magazines like New Scientist write about it on a regular basis. The president of the Royal Society holds this view and suffers no attacks as a result of it. It is an extraordinary thing that in some areas, like physics, people can put forward outrageously counterintuitive views and get away with it, Whereas in this area, the resistance is very, very strong. And I think it comes from an ideological basis, from the ideology of materialism. And that's why I think that it's so controversial and why we're dealing all the time, not just with evidence, but with a huge amount of baggage of a philosophical and ideological kind.
You know, I was going to move on, but I really think we ought to let Rich, you had a lot to say there, so let's see if Dr. Richard Wiseman, you'd like to kind of weigh in on that.
Yeah, I mean, in terms of, I don't get caught up on the human thing, so I think that's a bit of a red herring, but the way I was meaning that was not that these experiences are commonplace in terms of members of the public, which they certainly are, but rather in terms of science, in terms of the scientific worldview we've built up. The notion that someone was psychic or could predict the future is quite a radical idea, and that's where the Humean concept of therefore it'd be easy to think that your witnesses or even your scientists were lying or mistaken rather than embrace that would come from. In terms of are we dealing just with evidence here, I think Rupert's absolutely right. No, we're not. You know, scientists are human and they've got all the biases that everyone else has got. Yes, this is an area. One of the reasons I find parapsychology fascinating is that it is this kind of interface between evidence and belief. So, yes, I think it's absolutely the case that people don't assess the evidence in an objective way, one from one direction or the other, from a believer or a skeptical direction. But I do think it's the case that if the evidence were extremely strong, if it were overwhelming, if it was extremely convincing, then there would be a shift within mainstream science. I don't think that shift is impossible. I think the database just doesn't justify it at the moment.
Okay, I think that's going to roll right into the next question I have. I have one question for each of you, and then I want to give each of you a chance to respond like we just did. So, Dr. Wiseman, let's start with you again. And here's a quote that I think has generated quite a bit of stir, and let's kind of drill into it a little bit. And this is you being quoted in the UK's Daily Mail. I agree that by the standards of any other area of science, that remote viewing is proven, but begs the question, do we need higher standards of evidence when we study the paranormal? Then you went on in a subsequent interview and kind of further refine that by saying that's a slight misquote because I was using the term in more of a general sense of ESP. That is, I was not talking about remote viewing per se, but rather Ganzfeld, etc. as well. I think that they do meet the usual standards for a normal claim, but are not convincing enough for an extraordinary claim. Now, I think you can see where I'm going with this, but in your most recent article in the Skeptical Inquirer magazine titled Heads I Win, Tails You Lose, you begin with, after more than 6 years of experimentation, researchers have failed to reach a consensus about psi. The question, I guess, is this. Aren't these two quotes of yours really at odds? I mean, if parapsychology research has really brought us to the point of proving psychic abilities by the standards of any other area of science, I mean, isn't that quite an achievement? And shouldn't we be really commending that accomplishment? So I'm sure you're going to have a lot to say about that. So dig into it in any way you like.
Well, first of all, I do actually commend parapsychologists. And I would count myself as a parapsychologist. I've carried out research as well. I was very much part of that community, not so much now. And I do commend them for doing the research and doing it in a systematic way and attempting to be as scientific as possible. That has led us to a database which is messy in many ways. But if you take the general ESP claim, which might include Ganzfeld and some of the other ESP paradigms as well, I think it's true, and I don't know if there's any kind of objective way of actually measuring this, but my feeling is that if that were a claim about, I don't know, the effect of alcohol on memory, then we'd kind of go, yeah, there's probably something to it. But the claim here is far more radical than that. It would lead to a massive shift within science. It would overturn most of what we know within psychology. I don't know about other areas, but certainly within psychology. So for me, the evidential bar, as it were, needs to be much higher than that. And I sometimes say to people, you know, it's a bit like if I say, oh, outside in the road there's a car, you'd kind of go, well, fine, I don't feel the need to go outside and look at the car. If I say, well, it's a spaceship, then you might think, well, actually, I do want to look at that. You know, an alien spacecraft. And yeah, an alien spacecraft. Well, you wouldn't take my word for it. You'd go outside. You'd require a higher level of evidence. And I think that parapsychologists, despite not far off 100 years of research, have failed to come up with that level of evidence. That's not to say they couldn't in the future, but to me, there just hasn't been the level of progress that you would expect given the amount of work that's been put in. And so the article was really about how we might try and push that forward and try and get some closure, i.e. can we produce the level of evidence one would need, and if not, do we agree not to carry on with the endeavor?
Boy, before I even let Dr. Sheldrick get in there, I want to just drill into a couple points there. Because one, you seem to be saying that there should be some kind of subjective measure other than the normal means of science, peer review, the normal means we have in place for measuring certain claims that we're going to label as extraordinary. And I'm just wondering how we would and why we would layer on top of the system institution that we have on science, why we would layer that on top. And then number two, you kind of alluded to some, again, subjective sense of how much body of evidence would be required. And those just seem awful fuzzy to me.
Well, I think they are. I mean, the Bayesian approach to all of this is that your own belief system massively influences how much evidence you need. And so within mainstream science, as we've already said, people will be pretty skeptical about the idea of psychic ability because it overturns, you know, the current scientific worldview. So they will require a very strong database. And you can't really put numbers to it. You can't say, oh, 10 studies coming out of this lab and 2 studies out of here. It doesn't really work like that. But it is that notion. They will require a very strong database. And there is this kind of agreement, I think, from a lot of parapsychologists, not all, but a lot, that strength of evidence simply isn't there. There is a huge problem with replication. And unless you have some sort of phenomenon that replicates reliably outside of proponents running the experiments in particular, you won't get mainstream science taking Psy, as it were, on board.
Okay, Dr. Sheldrick?
Yeah, again, I come back to the fact what we're dealing here with is an ideological issue. I mean, what Richard calls mainstream science, and you know, there's a kind of materialistic faith that many scientists have, at least in public. Many of them in private have telepathic experiences and have quite different views. But nevertheless, he's right, there is a kind of materialistic ethos in science. But I think that itself is something we need to question and look at, because it leads to an extraordinary blindness. I mean, he said that if you said there's a car outside, you wouldn't need to look. If you said there's a spaceship, you would, because that's an incredible claim. Well, it's okay for cosmologists to claim there's entire universes out there, whole other universes, not just one, but trillions. No one bothers to look. There's no evidence at all. The reason that gets passed the filters is it doesn't overturn a particular ideology. And what's at stake is not science itself, but ideology. It's not as if science has a conclusive theory of consciousness. Psi phenomena are related to consciousness in some way. No one knows quite how. But it's not as if established science has a completely watertight, good theory of consciousness. It doesn't. Consciousness studies is one of the frontier areas of science where there's no consensus at all. It's one of the areas where science is most open, least fixed, least certain. And so I don't think it's true that it would involve a huge overturn of established science. It would be a shock to people who have a strong atheist or materialist faith that excludes psychic phenomena. But I don't think for science itself, actual scientific theories of consciousness, it would necessarily be a huge shock, because we don't have good theories of consciousness. In fact, this would help us develop them, I think, if we took into account psychic phenomena.
Very good. Dr. Wiseman?
I'm not an expert on consciousness. I don't know that area very well, but certainly within psychology, I think we kind of don't have a problem. We don't see studies being run on memory or perception or whatever, where people seem to be able to do extraordinary things. And we go, my goodness, you know, how did they know which number was going to come up next in the memory sequence? So in a sense, if they did, you notice that anomaly and seek an explanation for it. But people are not doing that. And I do think they find the idea that, oh my goodness, people might be psychic and looking to the future or being able to communicate telepathically. That would be quite an overturning of certainly even the experimental method, because suddenly getting control groups or whatever would be extremely difficult. So I think it would certainly within psychology be seen as a massive shift in how we understand human abilities.
Okay, but before I leave this, I just can't help but come back to this point again, though. I mean, if we're talking about proving psychic abilities by the standards of any other area of science, and then at the same time we're talking about the mainstream science in this institution that can't be overturned, and there's this huge upheaval that would happen, how would we ever get to the point then? And I guess you've said that there would be some massive amount of data that would come in very convincingly from a number of different sources. How do we ever get over the hump in terms of having that paradigm shift, having that change? When do the standards become enough? And who are we really looking to? Who are we looking to convince? How will we know we're progressing along that line, or maybe not progressing along that line? Either one of you.
Well, maybe I could sort of jump in there first. These things are not all just kind of objective. It's not like there's a kind of bench of 10 scientists.
Exactly,
you have to convince.
Right.
It doesn't work like that. I think that a quote objective scientist, whatever that means, somebody who hasn't got an axe to grind in one direction or another with the psi question, if they looked at the experimental database currently, they would say, well, that's interesting. You know, there's clearly pockets of significance which are rather curious. The problem in the sciences is a very important thing, particularly in psychology, as I said before, is one of replication. And I think if parapsychologists could solve that problem, and this is not a novel idea, certainly not my idea, parapsychologists themselves have been talking about it for decades, if you could say, here's an experiment which you can conduct, and we have a very good chance that you will capture psi in the lab, and that allows you then to vary conditions and so on, that would be a huge step towards acceptance within the mainstream scientific community, and that probably means just more people doing that type of research and publishing on it. But without that, most scientists will look at it and go, oh my goodness, why should I bother trying to do these experiments when the parapsychologists themselves are telling me this stuff doesn't replicate? So I think that would be the issue.
Any thoughts on any of that, Dr. Sheldrick?
Yes. Well, I mean, I'm in favor of replication too, so we completely agree about that. I think that when we look at the existing body of evidence, in Richard's article in Skeptical Inquirer called Heads I Win, Tails You Lose, How Parapsychologists Nullify Null Results, he's, of course, preaching to the choir in the Skeptical Inquirer. This is a highly skeptical magazine with 60,000 or so subscribers who are committed, most of them, to a skeptical position. And his article paints a very unflattering picture of parapsychology, and it makes it sound as if, you know, these results are completely unreproducible, it hasn't really got anywhere, etc. But he said something at the end I completely agree with, which is that when you look at the data, it's rather like, where is it? This giddy process results in an ambiguous data set that, just like the classical optical illusion of the old hag and the attractive young woman, never contains enough information to allow closure in one direction or another. I agree with him on that. And the old hag and the beautiful young woman is my experience, too, of the heads I win, tails you lose. He claims that parapsychologists explain away null results. But my experience is that skeptics explain away positive ones, and for skeptics, it's heads I win, tails you lose. Whenever I get experimental data, for example, in my telephone telepathy tests, which seem to show a telepathic effect, the main reaction of skeptics is not to say, how fascinating, let's try and replicate them. One or two have reacted like that. The main reaction I get is, oh, well, the experience must have been flawed. And people don't even feel they need to spell out the flaw in many cases. They just dismiss them as flawed if they're positive. And, you know, I've had a paper rejected from a journal where they said any positive evidence for parapsychology shows the paper's flawed, and therefore there's no point in even refereeing it. So this level of prejudice is very, very widespread. And that's why I think that closure in these conditions is not going to be very easy. But my own view about replication is that we need to find experiments that can be done quite widely. That's why I'm working on automated telephone telepathy experiments, because I think through new media, if we enable large numbers of people to do experiments, standardized experiments with valid statistical randomizations, then it might be possible to achieve very high levels of replication. And so actually a lot of my own research agenda is directed exactly to that issue. So I think we agree about the importance of replication. But one thing I'd like to say about Richard's research is that in many ways, you see, there's an extraordinary thing. Parapsychologists, I mean, skeptics are often saying parapsychologists get all this publicity. Actually, skeptics get a huge amount, and none get more than Richard. And I think that this skeptical publicity actually sets back the cause of replication. People in the scientific community, if they think about these things at all, rely on reports they get in things like New Scientist or the Daily Telegraph. And when they read in the Daily Telegraph that Richard's done a Twitter experiment on remote viewing, and sadly it's given negative results, more or less as he expected, and yet another piece of evidence against parapsychology. This has a huge effect on shaping the negative attitude and making it much, much less likely that people think it's worth giving any funding to this field or worth wasting any time in it or getting student projects in psychology labs and so forth. So this is part of the maintaining of this negative attitude, which actually freezes the situation and prevents the kind of replication. And so, Richard, I think that your attitudes are extraordinarily ambiguous. On the one hand, you're really interested in the field and you've made positive contributions to it. But on the other hand, your public activities often seem to be designed to undermine the field and to reduce any chance of replication or funding or interest, because you portray it as being something that just doesn't work.
Good. I was really worried we're all being way too nice to each other. So let's use that as a launching point. Dr. Wiseman, please respond.
Well, first of all, I think being nice to each other is a good thing.
I was totally being facetious. Okay. But I think this does get to the... No, let me say that, because I very much appreciate you coming on, and I appreciate the dialogue. But I think when we gloss over things with, oh, we're all in this together, we'd all like to get to the truth, we all believe in science, I mean, these kind of platitudes don't really move the discussion along. Of course we'd all like convincing evidence, we'd like more replicability, all that stuff. But let's get back to Dr. Sheldrick's last point, because that stance that you're taking in terms of yay for parapsychology, come on just a little bit further, does belie some of the other, at least the perception that many people have about some of your research and some of the positions you take, particularly inside the skeptical community.
Well, I think with any of the experiments, often the parapsychologists are very skeptical of them when they come out with the null hypothesis being supported. So if the Twitter experiment had come out positive, then that would be a great thing for parapsychology. So the same experiment with the same design can either be seen as a terrible thing when it comes out null or a great thing when it comes out positive. So I think all of these things, whether they're public experiments or private or lab-based experiments, need to go into the mix. I would say that the problem with this field is basically that this stuff doesn't replicate. And we can keep kind of going, well, there's not much funding and mainstream science doesn't take it seriously and you get rejected for journals, all of that. And I'm sure all of it is true to some extent. I'm sure that is the case. However, for me, the basic problem is that for about 90-100 years, parapsychologists have been looking for this thing, and it's proved to be remarkably elusive. And what I talk about in the Skeptic Inquirer article is this kind of a jumping from one ship to another. It used to be card guessing, dream telepathy, and then it's Ganzfeld, and then it's remote viewing. And the reason those jumps have occurred is this stuff does not replicate. And that's caused some parapsychologists, I don't think Rupert, but I'm not certain, some parapsychologists to argue there is something about psi, which means it kind of knows when not to replicate, as it were. That as either the conditions get tighter, psi doesn't come out because it sort of knows not to,
or after a while it will naturally fade away and you need a new paradigm. So it's kind of arguing a sort of godlike omnipotence to Psi. That's how far they've had to go to explain the lack of replication. So I think a more healthy attitude would be to say, hold on a second, how can we stop this? How can we stop this happening in the future so that in the next 10 years we're not in the same position again and we can reach some kind of closure? And that may include, my goodness, shock horror, being open to the fact that Psi doesn't exist and we've been kidding ourselves all the way along. So that's where I've been really arguing with the article.
Dr. Sheldrick, what do you think about Dr. Wiseman's attempts to, quote-unquote, replicate Psi experiments through public demonstrations and other means, as well as other skeptical researchers' attempts to replicate this work?
The Twitter experiment was an example of something he criticizes parapsychologists for, trying out new things, jumping from one ship to another. This was trying out something new. It was trying it out in a very public way, in an experiment that was almost, I wouldn't like to say it was deliberately designed to fail, but everybody who heard about it that knew anything about remote viewing predicted it would fail. To me, it looks like an experiment designed to capture enormous publicity, to give an almost guaranteed negative Psi result, and therefore to create, muddy the whole water about the whole subject and set back any positive, considered discussion of the field. It didn't. His Twitter experiment certainly didn't live up to the guidelines for extrasensory perception research written by himself and Julie Milton. It wasn't very well done. The data have never been published in detail, as far as I know. When I asked for details on the number of actual participants, Richard gave me some rough figures. He said, if my memory serves me correctly. This is not serious science. And yet it masquerades as serious science and gets far more publicity than people who are prepared to do years of heavy lifting in this field. So for me, the problem is that this kind of approach, this kind of highly publicized approach of experiments designed to fail, is not helping the case of replication. It's muddying the waters and actually helping to create the impression that there are all these null results. I think that it's a funny thing, you see, when I talk to you privately, you seem totally reasonable, but your public persona seems quite different. When you become a showman who's doing stunts that seem to me designed to try and undermine any belief that people might have in the scientific validity of Psi.
Well, just to come back on a couple of those points. So the Twitter experiment, I think, is methodologically sound. I mean, one of the things I'm interested in is actually using new media like Twitter for experiments, outside of parapsychology as well, and that was part of the remit there. Just in terms of the data, and this is kind of interesting because it gets back to one of Rupert's points earlier on, we have written it up. It was submitted for publication, and it was rejected. So that's a case of a very sort of high-profile null result being rejected by a journal, mainly because they didn't like actually publishing null results. So it's kind of an interesting one. But we will submit it somewhere else, and hopefully it will eventually make it into the public domain. So I don't get too distracted on that away from... I think what is the core problem, which is that within parapsychology, even the parapsychologists themselves say, we don't have something which is a replicable phenomenon, and that's a huge problem. And so the article, and this is what...
Who in particular is saying that?
Oh, pretty much everyone in parapsychology, as far as I know. I mean, there are entire conferences have been held on a lack of replication. I mean, not everyone. There are some people that argue that it does replicate. But the majority, I understand, know that there is a problem.
Well, the folks that I've had on my show, we're talking to one, Dr. Sheldrick, but certainly Dean Radin at the IONS Institute. It feels that his presentiment experiment has been replicated at least a dozen times by numerous labs all over the world. I think the Global Consciousness Project has an enormous amount of data that's been analyzed and sliced and diced by many different people, and we're currently involved in a collaboration with Dr. Chris French. So I think we have to be careful in kind of where we throw around those terms. And I would have to kind of take exception with, this not the point that was just being discussed, not really being the main heart of it, because I think what it gets to, and what Dr. Sheldrick was trying to get to, is... if we were really trying to replicate remote viewing, which you've said has been proven by any normal standards of scientific investigation, blah, 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 whatever that was, Why wouldn't we go to the folks who have already said they've isolated the phenomena? Why wouldn't we do a real replication of something that has shown some results rather than, I understand your desire to experiment with new media, and that's understandable, but how would we ever replicate if we don't go to the folks who've already done the work?
Well, the problem is, if you look at, say, some of the other big databases, the RNG database, for example, huge amount of effort put in by Freiburg to try and replicate that. No results straight across the board. So it's a complete disaster in terms of replication. If you look at the Ganzfeld database, you know, it looks good for a while, and there's no one arguing now that, that effect has replicated. There are still pockets of significance, there's no doubt about that, but you wouldn't argue for widespread replication. If you look at the remote viewing literature, as far as I know, that there's no replicable effect there. I don't know where you would kind of go to get that. I mean, there's a few studies which show very, very marginal effects. But I don't know what literature you'd point to go, there you go, there's the guys doing it, you know, day in, day out with a huge effect size. So this is not a sort of strong literature. What happens is that these things come into play, into fashion, and presentiment is a good example of it. A fairly recent player in the field comes into fashion, and then you'll find this stuff doesn't replicate, and then everyone jumps ship to another paradigm. And that's very, very problematic.
I don't think you'd get a lot. I don't think you'd get the kind of agreement that you think on that. But let me back off and let Dr. Sheldrick step in on that point.
Well, first of all, when it comes to Ganzfeld, there have been many studies, there have been many meta-analyses. You did one that showed no effect. Most other meta-analyses have shown there was an effect. So there's been a dispute, but not every experiment in Ganzfeld works. Not every clinical trial of antidepressant like Prozac works. In medicine, when you're dealing with human phenomena, in clinical trials, a whole other field, sometimes they give positive results, sometimes they don't. Sometimes it's no better than placebo. That's why meta-analysis is used in these areas where you don't have total reproducibility. And medicine is a perfect example of a science where you can't just go into a lab and do the same, get the same effect every single time with drugs, because it's a complex situation. So meta-analysis seems to be a perfectly valid way of going about it, and most side phenomena, like Ganzfeld, most meta-analyses do show replicable effects. When we look at other phenomena, the ones I've looked at myself, for example, which you don't mention in your article, I've been sort of airbrushed out of your view of parapsychology, but the dogs that know when their owners are coming home, perhaps this isn't the moment to get into our disagreements about that, but there's a phenomenon that I've replicated with a different dog. You did some experiments that gave results that showed a similar pattern to my own, and you interpreted them differently. But that's not exactly as if hundreds of people have tried to do this, and it just hasn't replicated. Insofar as it's been done, it looks like a replicable pattern with differences of interpretation. When it comes to telephone telepathy, a field in which I've worked for quite a number of years now, my own experiments have replicated. I've done one for television which was replicated under controlled conditions. It's been replicated at the University of Amsterdam. It's been replicated at the University of Freiburg. These are all published replications in peer-reviewed journals. So again, I just don't recognize this picture that you're painting. I'm trying to do a replication with Chris French, but you know, he's been saying he's about to begin for the last 9 months, and as of today, they still haven't begun. So, you know, I haven't found that when I have tried to work with skeptics, principally with Chris French, that, you know, he's so busy being a skeptic in the media or on television, there's not much time left for the heavy lifting of actual experimental work. And so I just don't recognize this picture of failure to replicate, the sense of being stared at. It's been widely replicated. You yourself did experiments on it. Your first ones gave positive results. Then you became the starer yourself. Then there was an experimental effect. You rather dismiss experimental effects in your article as a mere excuse that parapsychologists bring up, but the best evidence for them is your own studies with Marilyn Schlitz, where she got positive significant effects and you got non-significant ones. She did the looking in her trials, you did the looking in yours. This is, seems to me, a fairly consistent picture. This sort of broad brush picture you paint in the Skeptical Inquiry, mostly in vague generalities, doesn't fit with the way I see the data myself, nor with my own experiences.
They're interesting points, and it could be that we're talking about slightly different things here. I mean, just to get back to the staring study briefly, Marilyn and I ran some studies. The last one, which was the largest one, didn't show any effect at all, so we actually failed to replicate the experimenter effect there. So there are issues with replicating that as well. I think what I mean by the term, and you're absolutely right, you never expect 100% studies to replicate. It just doesn't work like that. The problem with doing meta-analysis is that it's almost by definition, it's retrospective. So there's always issues about file draw, about multiple analyses, about how you cut the data as to which studies are included, which ones are excluded, which conditions you take within a study, and so on. There are a lot of decisions that go into a meta-analysis, and that's why often they're so controversial. What I'm suggesting in the Skeptical Inquirer article is that we do what's really required in the gold standard of science, which is say, okay, prospectively, let us run 10 studies, let's suppose 10 Ganswell studies. Let us run them under conditions where we think they are maximally psi conducive and also minimize any possible experimental artifact. So we get rid of the idea of multiple analyses and cherry-picking studies and so on, and we agree how many of those studies would have to come out significant in order that we agree the effect is replicated, and then we get on and we do that. Now, when you go into that prospective phase, suddenly parapsychologists are not quite so certain about what conditions are psi-conducive. They say, well, we got it in the past, we don't know whether we're going to get it in the future, we don't know whether it'll work under this circumstance or this circumstance, and that's what I mean about the lack of replication.
But why do you say that? Who is saying they won't sign up on that program? I think there's plenty of folks that I've spoken with that would sign up on that deal right now. We want to prospectively lay out the terms for replication and get everyone involved. I think we could find the folks to do it, qualified folks.
If you could, then that's great. If we could all sit around the table and go and say something like the Ganswelt, which is very well understood in terms of methodology, would be a very good one. We'd all sit around the table, we go 10 studies, we're going to do it, and that's fine. I would add the caveat that having gone through that entire procedure, if it all turns out to be null, you can't jump ship to another paradigm, or maybe you can once more, but you can't carry on in the future forever like that.
I think you'd get people to agree with that too.
Okay, then in which case, that would be absolutely fine. My guess is that people who've really gone out there and done this stuff will be kind of reluctant to say that. That's my guess. They might say it in public, but when it comes to push comes to shove, in a very high-profile and important activity like that, they might not feel quite so confident. I may well be wrong.
I don't want to speak for Dean Radin, but I think Dean Radin does those kind of experiments every day. I visited him for an interview at his location a few months ago, and he sets up and does those kind of things, if not on a daily basis, on a very regular basis. So, yeah, I think we could find folks that you would agree are qualified to do that kind of thing, and I'm sure we could get Dr. Sheldrick to participate in some way in that as well. I don't want to speak for you. You're right here on the line, Dr. Sheldrick.
As I said, one of the things I'm trying to do is develop automated procedures like the automated telephone telepathy test. It's already up and running, and do replications using an agreed procedure, which should be standardized for everyone because it's automated, with different groups doing it. I'm already trying to do that. I'm already trying to do it with skeptics, Chris French's group. The problem is to get them to do it, because they're too busy doing other things. We've got the funding.
I think Dr. Wiseman's offering to participate in that process and at least be one of the people at the table engaging with other skeptics to do that. Is that right, Dr. Wiseman?
Well, yeah. I mean, I must say that I'm not sort of saying this off the top of my head. I've sat around the table with parapsychologists where we have tried to come up with these sorts of procedures where they would be very confident that they would get an effect, and they have displayed that confidence. They've kind of said, well, you know, it kind of seemed to work in the past, but you never know, and so on.
So I'm not coming from a sort of total position of having any experience of that. But certainly, I think the way forward would be to get, 10 people, a small number of skeptics and a greater number of parapsychologists to agree what is the best shot currently, what's the best shot? And it'd be really interesting to know whether they even agree with that, to be honest. Because it may be one would go GANS, another would go telephone telepathy, another would go presentiment. It might be very difficult to even get that consensus.
And I don't think I think from practical terms you're saying we couldn't have very many, but I think we could say if it was Ganzfeld and telephone telepathy, then it's just a matter of agreeing on some kind of protocol prospectively and some kind of path towards publication and peer review. I think all those things are very doable. It just takes an effort and an interest on all parties to do it. And I think everyone agrees that something like that is necessary to kind of break us out of this logjam that we seem to be in terms of spinning around. I mean, this discussion we're having here could have been had 5 or 10, it was conducted 5 years ago and 10 years ago. So we need something to break us out of this.
I completely agree with that. That's one of the reasons I wrote the article. I think the worry is, if the field carries on as carried on in the past, there's not going to be any difference that we're going to have. It'll be other people, but some will be having this discussion in 10, 20 years' time, instead of, I think, where there could be a real sense of closure one way or the other. And that's not to say that sense of closure isn't difficult. It is, and I take on board Rupert's points about, obviously, there's ideology at play as well. But I think we could certainly help the process by going, right, instead of everyone doing different things and pulling in different directions and so on, let's sit around the table. We've got limited resources. It's getting harder and harder to do any kind of fringe science within mainstream sort of activities at the moment, parapsychology included. So let's use those limited resources in a sensible way.
Okay, I think we need to wrap this up given the time that we put this on. Dr. Sheldrick, any final thoughts from you?
Yes, I'm in favor of an agreed group of people, prospectively setting up replications. It's just a matter of how does one make that happen. So that's partly, I agree with that, the need for replications. And as I say, a lot of my current work is designed towards that, to create conditions where that could happen. But I do think that this Richard's desire for closure is unrealistic because, even if you did an experiment, you got all the parapsychologists in the world, and there aren't many of them, 20 or something, full-time parapsychologists, maybe less. Even if they all signed up to this replication, even if it gave negative results, and if they all said, as you'd like them to say, Richard, okay, we give up, we'll undergo some job retraining thing, and we'll just become regular psychologists. And it's not going to go away. People are going to go on having psychic experiences. Dogs are going to go on knowing when their owners are coming home. The media are going to go on reporting these things. It's just that there'll be nobody left in the academic world with any expertise in these areas who could comment on them or research them. And on the other hand, say it gives a positive result. Say all 10 locations all get positive results for presentiment or telephone telepathy. Is the skeptical inquiry going to go out of business? Are the skeptic groups going to wind themselves up? Are skeptics around the world going to say, oh, we're not skeptics anymore, it's all proved? They're not. They're going to go on saying the experiments were flawed, there was something wrong with the procedure. If only they'd had different methods and more rigorous methodology, this result wouldn't have happened and there must have been collusion of some kind. That's just not going to happen. So I think that I'm in favor of the replication, but I think it's completely unrealistic to assume that the phenomena will go away, that there'll be a closure. I don't think there can be a closure because the evidence is going to keep appearing. People are not going to stop having spontaneous examples of telepathy with themselves or their pets or other psychic phenomena. And there are always going to be skeptics who are essentially coming from a materialist or atheist ideological point of view. I don't think myself that materialism or atheism need be against parapsychology. In fact, quite a number of leading parapsychologists like Dick Biermann are materialists and atheists. They're looking for an expanded form of materialism. So I think, in fact, it's not really an issue of religion versus no religion or even materialism versus non-materialism. I think it's a problem of a very narrow kind of dogmatic materialism. That's not going to go away however much evidence there is. It may gradually die out or decline as an ideology. But closure won't arise from this replication, whichever way it goes, and even if it's sort of ambiguous and gives a marginal effect, I think it's an unrealistic dream. So I'm all in favour of more research, more experiments, more replications, cooperative endeavours. But I just think your dream of closure, Richard, isn't going to happen.
Dr. Wiseman, why don't we give you the final word on this?
Oh, I'm actually more optimistic. I mean, you're absolutely right. There will be people out there who are not going to change their opinion one way or the other. But we're not really interested in them because, by definition, they're not very interesting people who won't change their opinion. If you had 10 people sitting around a table and the skeptics agreed on the methodology and the parapsychologists and maybe a few people who hadn't got particular interest in the field but were prepared to do some experiments, if they all went away and you got an impressive rate of replication, I don't think all skeptics would turn around and go, oh, well, there was a problem, let's just ignore that. They would be rather curious about that and want to engage in that debate, and possibly that would lead to further work and so on. So I'm not that pessimistic about it. What I am pessimistic about is the future of the field without something like that. As we all know, the funding is getting harder and harder to obtain, and I think we need to use the resources in a very, very careful way. So I would say it's worth a go. We haven't done it before, and if we continue what we've done in the past, we're not going to move on very quickly. So I'm slightly more optimistic.
Well, very good. I want to thank you both very much for participating in this dialogue. These kind of give-and-take dialogues are really, as you two have demonstrated, are really not that difficult, are not that challenging or adversarial, or they don't have to be. This was certainly very pleasant, but there really isn't enough of them. And with regard to your last point, Dr. Wiseman, I will personally move that forward and agree to fund that to some degree to see that happen, because whether Dr. Sheldrick is right in terms of providing closure and whether he's right that the cynical skeptics will never be moved over, I don't know. But I do agree with you, Dr. Wiseman, that we have no choice other than to push in that direction. It's the only way that makes sense. So thanks again so much to both of you for joining me today on Skeptico.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you.
Okay, so that's how we wrap things up. And I have to tell you, at the end of that debate, I really anticipated that there would be a significant follow-up, but I never anticipated the one that I was going to get. So after the debate, I immediately emailed Sheldrick and said, hey, you know, Wiseman seems to be open to collaboration, and I think it's something that should be followed up on. And he had some mixed feelings, but basically said he was open to that. So I followed up with Wiseman and began this email exchange that I want to share with you now. It's quite a lengthy email exchange, but it's fascinating. I mean, to me, it gets to the very heart of Skeptico. It's revealing in so many ways. So what I've done is put together all the emails in order, and I'm fortunate enough to have found an actor from Hollywood, actually Burbank area. His name is Bruce Mann, and Bruce is about ready to run off to perform in a theater production he's doing, but he was nice enough to come in here and sit in for me and do a reading playing Dr. Richard Wiseman, and I'm going to read to you my emails, and he's going to read to you the responses from Dr. Wiseman. So, Bruce, thanks so much for doing this.
My pleasure.
Okay, so we're going to begin with the first email that I sent to Dr. Wiseman on February 26th. After the show, and then we're going to go through all the emails with the last one ending on March the 6th. So this first email begins, "Hi, Dr. Wiseman. Thanks again for joining me on Skeptico a few weeks back. It's almost ready to air. Your dialogue with Dr. Sheldrick was terrific. Of course, it will end up being just another forgettable debate if we don't follow up along the lines discussed. To that end, I have contacted several Psi researchers about your suggestions/proposal. Dr. Roger Nelson, Global Consciousness Project, Dr. Dean Radin, Presentiment, and Dr. Sheldrick, Telephone Telepathy, have all expressed willingness to explore the possibility of creating a forum for skeptics and believers. Everyone hates those terms, but we're stuck with them. To collaborate. Here's a suggested, very high-level game plan. Number one, identify and invite forum participants. Perhaps you could identify who you would like to invite on your side for each of the above experiments. I'll ask the same of Nelson, Radin, and Sheldrick, but those three will probably be sufficient. Number two, review current research. I'll ask each Psi researcher to compile a summary of their research, including published and unpublished documentation. The group will review the research and make recommendation for future collaborative experiments. Three, fund small-scale Psi replication experiments.
4. Report results. Sound reasonable? Please let me know any suggestions you may have. I'd like to schedule a follow-up discussion, our first forum of skeptics and believers, for March. Doable? Best, Alex.
Hi. Thanks for that. I think the first stage would be for proponents to come up with their best shot. That is, the design which they, as a group, believe has the best chance of eliciting psi effect. Will be interesting to see if they can do it. Cheers, Richard.
Okay, but it's hard to sell such a give-me-your-best-shot offer to psi researchers. They believe they've replicated experiments demonstrating psi effects. They're likely to shoot back with a give-me-your-best-shot, and this gets us nowhere. I'd like to find a way to keep the dialogue going and move things in the direction slash spirit of your proposal without setting too many preconditions. We got a lot of smart guys here. You'll figure out the proper next steps. I just want to make sure y'all keep talking. Are you in for an hour-long conference call in late March? We can set directions slash timeline slash goals, etc. during this first session and aim for something like what you're suggesting for the second forum. Also, happy to invite skeptical journalist slash podcaster to jointly participate. I'd suggest DJ Grothy's for good reason. Best, Alex.
If they think that, then it's just a question of them saying which database and conditions are best. I really think the first stage for them is to identify their strongest evidence and say that they think the effect will replicate. When we tried to do this in Vancouver, no one would promise anything.
I think everyone needs to feel comfortable with the process and the fairness of it. That's why I'm suggesting we use the first session to jointly decide stages and the like. Will you agree to join us for such a session? Alex.
I am just so busy at the moment that I'm turning down stuff all over the place. I don't really want to get sucked into something. I would suggest that you have the initial chat with the proponents and see where it goes.
I've had initial conversations via email with Nelson, Radin, and Sheldrick. They're all confident that they can deliver the goods if the rules are clear and the forum is fair. I think we need a first session to make everyone confident this won't be agenda-driven. I understand the time restraints. I'll do my best to accommodate schedules and make efficient use of time. This initial commitment is 1 hour in late March, at a time convenient to you and other participants. After this first session, we can do a lot of work offline with occasional email exchanges. We'll have another session when the experiments slash protocols take shape. Can I count you in, Alex?
As I've said, get the experiment and conditions sorted and then get back to me.
Not sure what you're asking for. All these guys have published their experiments, and they've agreed to meet and discuss collaboration with you and other skeptics. I like the ideas you put forth in our interview, but they're going to take a little follow-through. This seems like such a small step. What's the holdup, Alex?
We just need them to agree on what the front runner is. Let's assume that we can only do one type of study. What's the best one to do to have the best chance of yielding a psi effect?
That definitely needs to be on the table, maybe the first thing, but we're not going to get anywhere if the perception is that you're dictating preconditions. I think I can get Sheldrick, Radin, and Nelson to show up with an open mind and a willingness to enter into the dialogue. I'm asking you to do the same. Just 1 hour, will you? Alex.
I am running out of ways of saying no. Have a chat with them and see if they agree about the best paradigm.
Next, I responded to a couple of his lines. When he said, I'm running out of ways to say no, I said, if that means you're moving closer to agreeing, that's good, smiley face. And then when he said, have a chat with them and see if they agree to the best paradigm, I said, okay, I'm happy to have another chat with Sheldrick, Radin, and Nelson about this, but I can't really insist they decide which of their experiments best suits this format. As you know, each of these researchers is partial to their own. I'll be in touch. Alex. So then it took me a few days and an additional amount of arm twisting, but I got in touch with all three of them and then was able to respond back to Dr. Wiseman with this. Dr. Wiseman, per your request, I've recontacted Sheldrick, Nelson, and Radin. As I expected, they're open to a dialogue about replicating their experiments. but they balked at the idea of setting preconditions before an initial dialogue. As they pointed out to me, a real dialogue about replicating psi experiments would have to include a discussion about the role skeptics, and you in particular, have played in past experiments to isolate psi phenomena through collaborative experimentation, and the apparent double standard between the levels of control you deem appropriate for your psi experiments, example, your Twitter RV experiment, versus the standards you demand of psi proponents. I think our initial discussion has to be about establishing a level of trust among all parties. It's going to take a new level of openness and fairness among everyone involved if we're going to design experiments with the best chance for success. Again, I hope you'll agree to follow through with this dialogue in the spirit of collaboration you expressed during our interview. Best, Alex.
I don't really get this. All we need is for them to agree about the best shot re-replicating psi. That should be a straightforward question.
What's not to get? They want to be sure the process will be fair. As far as which experiment, as you know, each of these guys has spent years on their work. It's not a trivial matter to ask which experiment is best suited for replication. That's why we need you involved, smiley face. Moreover, the collaboration process we're contemplating doesn't require one singular experiment, just that we design, run, replicate good experiments. I'd like to reach some closure on this before I publish our interview. You left listeners with the impression that you were open to collaborating with Psi researchers. If you are, then I'd expect that you'd be more willing to follow through. I've asked you to spend 1 hour in dialogue with Psi researchers. That's a very small commitment. You've been very reluctant to accept this invitation. Why? Alex.
Because I get loads of invites to stuff. It is very simple. They just decide on the best paradigm and conditions for the study, and that's that. It really doesn't require my input. However, once they have come back with an answer, then I'm happy to think about how best to move forward remaking it happen.
I know you and Sheldrick and Nelson and Raiden get loads of invites to stuff. But as we discussed in the interview, and as you can see from this email exchange, we're at a bit of an impasse. It doesn't seem like asking everyone to spend an hour on the phone discussing ground rules and basic parameters is out of line. I keep asking you why you won't agree to this initial meeting. The only answer I get is that we don't need one. This seems like a unilateral decision slash demand, since everyone else thinks we do. It's not the best way to begin a collaboration. Please join us for an hour-long phone conference discussing how we might engage in a collaboration between skeptics and Psi proponents, to be jointly hosted by me and a skeptical journalist of your choosing. Or just tell me you're not interested. Alex.
Totally interested in the idea of them saying what is their best paradigm, but you don't need me for that initial call.
I hear you saying that you're totally interested in hearing what they think is the best paradigm for testing Psi, and you're not interested in the initial dialogue I have proposed. Is that correct, Alex?
Yes. The question to them is, what paradigm, as in Gantz or telephone telepathy or presentiment, is most likely to yield evidence for Psi? And what conditions, e.g. if Gantz, video targets, and creative participants, and number, size of such experiments would be needed. See if they can agree on an answer. You don't need me for that.
This is a non-starter. We're at about round 20 of this email exchange, and I can't even get your buy-in for a call on basic ground rules. The perception among some Psi proponents is that you don't play fair regarding Psi science. I don't think this email exchange is going to change that, but it may surprise a lot of skeptics. Let me know if you change your mind regarding a dialogue with Psi proponents without preconditions. Thanks again for taking part in the Skeptico interview and for sharing your views via email. All the best, Alex.
Well, that is the question that matters, so it will be interesting to see what they say. Just to repeat, what paradigm, as in Gantz or telephone telepathy or presentiment, is most likely to yield evidence for Psi? And what conditions, e.g. Gantz, video targets, and creative participants, and number size of such experiments would be needed? I think lots of people would be amazed if the parapsychologist couldn't come up with an answer.
And my final email was just, okay, thanks.
So there you have it. No need to do a lot of editorializing. If you listen to any of the past episodes of Skeptico, I've done all the editorializing I need to do there. And I have to say that despite that email exchange, through this whole process, I think I actually gained a better insight for where Dr. Richard Wiseman is coming from. I don't agree with it. I don't agree with it at all. I think this entrenched kind of warfare between skeptics and psi proponents is really a lose-lose deal. But I understand how the battle lines have been drawn, I guess, even more clearly than I ever have before. And despite any kind of arm-waving and denial to the contrary, this is where we find ourselves right now. So I'll be real interested to see what Skeptico listeners think about this, both on the skeptical side and on the proponent side. And I hope, and actually I know, you'll let me know what you do think. So that's going to do it for this episode of Skeptico. Thank you for hanging in for another rather long episode, but I think it was worth it. I liked everything we were able to get out to you. I'm very, very happy with it. So I hope you like it. I hope you tell your friends about it. I hope you blog about it. I hope you share this information with as many people as you feel would find it useful and valuable. If you'd like any information about all our previous shows, please check out the Skeptico website. It's at skeptiko, don't forget the K, .com. You'll find there a link to our forums, or you can enter into a discussion, an email link to me, also the Facebook link to me, and some links to additional information on this show and some of the folks who appeared on it. That's going to do it for today. Have a couple other really, really great episodes coming up, including a very interesting interview with Dr. G.M. Worley, who is an anesthesiologist who is very, very skeptical of the near-death experience research of Dr. Jeffrey Long. You're really going to want to hear that. So again, that's all for now. Until next time, bye for now.